Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Julia Child's Kitchen, the design, tools, stories, and legacy of an iconic space. By Paula J. Johnson. Foreword by Jacques Pepin. Narrated by Jacques Pepin and Elizabeth Wiley.
Foreword, a place of happiness. Julia's kitchen on Irving Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she cooked many meals for her family and friends, was a place of joy, conviviality, and entertainment. It was certainly different from the way a kitchen was generally seen in the American food culture of the 60s, a dreary, joyless, boring part of the house. American women were trying to escape the drudgery of kitchen work. But for Julia, it was a place of happiness. I remember entering the back door that opened right into her kitchen, the true heart of her house, for the first time. It was in the mid-70s, not long after I published that technique. I walked in, saw the big table covered with a colorful tablecloth and the crumbs that were left over from breakfast. She swept them away with her hand before she turned to me and asked, "What do you want to cook?" We had met for the first time at Helen Macaulay's apartment in New York City in 1960, and we had cooked together that first evening. Helen, the food editor of House Beautiful magazine, was reviewing the manuscript for Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and she wanted us to get together. We spoke French because Julia's French was better than the English at that time. Cooking with someone is a way of getting to know them, especially cooking in their home kitchen. Many years later, at the end of the 70s, I started teaching cooking at Boston University for a couple of weeks during each term. I always met Julia when I went to Boston, and we often cooked together in her kitchen. The pleasure we both took from cooking together cemented our friendship. In the mid-80s, we started giving classes together at BU. Julia's passion was to educate home cooks, and that itself explained why her home kitchen was so important. She was the first to say that she was not a chef. She had never worked in a restaurant kitchen, but brought her talent and love to the home kitchen. She was always interested in the latest and greatest kitchen gadget for the simple reason that she wanted to help make cooking more accessible and enjoyable for people. This is also evidenced by how she made her kitchen work for her. Everything was there: food processor, blender, mixer, large butcher block, pestle and mortar, and especially her big love, the large six-burner Garland stove, a professional, powerful stove that she put to good use. The counters were made to be comfortable for her height. The pegboard wall kept a big area of copper and cast iron pots and pans within reach at all time. Pots and pans were not to be hidden. They were decorative, handsome, and worth looking at. She was breaking free from a culture that imagined cooking was not worth people's time. On the contrary, cooking for her was to be shared, enjoyed, and experienced together. Julia elevated food from something that was simple, necessary fact of life, something that should be celebrated and considered with care and prepared with love. She also felt that cooking should be enjoyed and shared every day, not just on special occasions. That connection with food was what she wanted to share with people, and her kitchen was where that sharing happened. In 2001, I cooked with Julia in her kitchen the day before the Smithsonian came to disassemble and move it to Washington, D.C. It was a last hurrah, as well as a dinner to raise money for charity. We both cooked along with the 12 students in our class. We had chairs at the dining room table, and we moved back and forth between the kitchen and the dining room throughout the meal. It was fun. At this point, I had come to know Julia and her home and her kitchen very well. We were close friends, and we had filmed 22 episodes of Julia and Jack cooking at home there. That night was the first time I ate in the dining room, and I remember that we made corn and oyster chowder and apple galette, classic dishes that Julia liked to prepare and eat. I appreciate the Smithsonian preservation of our wonderful kitchen, and I'm happy to be part of sharing its history with everyone. I know that the memory of these meals we cook together and share together in their home kitchen will stay with me the rest of my life. We had fun, we drank wine, we share ideas, we argue, but most of all, we love our special time at the stove and around the table. Happy cooking, Jacques Pepin, 2024.
Introduction. The value of the real thing. On August 18, 2002, 3 days after her 90th birthday, Julia Child stepped into her home kitchen, turned around slowly, and declared, "I feel like turning something on and starting to cook." Under normal circumstances, this wouldn't have been an unusual comment. But Julia was in Washington, D.C., and inside an exhibition at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. The exhibition featured her home kitchen from Cambridge, Massachusetts, with every appliance, pot, pan, knife, and work of art placed precisely where it had been a year earlier when she closed the door on her Cambridge home after 40 years as America's favorite television cook, author, teacher, and gastronomic muse to return to her home state of California. A few hours later, Julia was joined at the museum by members of her family and some 40 chefs from D.C. area restaurants who had prepared special dishes in honor of her birthday and in celebration of her extraordinary gift to the American people, her home kitchen. Julia Child's kitchen, the design, tools, stories, and legacy of an iconic space, reveals the story of Julia Child and her famous kitchen from the moment she and her beloved husband Paul began renovating it in 1961 to the whoops of delight as visitors to the museum discover anew, or yet again, the kitchen where Julia tested recipes, rehearsed cooking programs, and cooked with and for family and friends, and where three of her television series were taped in the 90s. In the numerous articles, books, feature films, documentaries, and television shows that are still broadcast and available online, Julia herself is always the star, as well she should be. Julia is at the center of this book, too. But the story is told through her kitchen and the objects within, a story she began narrating herself almost as soon as the blue-green paint was dry on the kitchen cabinets. As we will learn in the chapters ahead, Julia spoke about her kitchen in great detail to journalists and food media, writers eager to interview this thoroughly charming and disarmingly knowledgeable woman about her popular cookbooks and television series. Julia often brought the conversation around to her home kitchen, describing the functional arrangements and aesthetic vision for her favorite room in the house. Over many years, she introduced readers and television audiences to specific tools that she used in her home kitchen, which was pictured regularly in popular publications from House and Garden to Architectural Digest, the New York Times Magazine, the Boston Globe, and many more. There was nothing mysterious or secretive about Julia Child's home kitchen. She made sure people knew that a serious cook needed a serious workspace. If Julia was the original narrator of her kitchen, this book picks up the narrative thread to reveal its, and Julia's, ongoing significance and legacy. As one of the museum staffers who met with Julia in 2001 to discuss the future of her home kitchen, I have spent much of the past 20-odd years immersed in American food history and delving deeply into the stories behind this marvelous room. I have had the joy and benefit of learning from and alongside my museum colleagues as we examined more than 1,000 objects that we collected and together created exhibitions and programs that have placed Julia and her kitchen into the larger context of American social and cultural history. But I must confess that cooking had never been my passion. Staying out of the kitchen was my goal as a college student in the 70s, when supporting the Equal Rights Amendment and the National Organization for Women appealed to my idea of a path to a bright future that could somehow accommodate my ambitions for a career outside the home. But after moving from the Midwest to the East Coast and entering the museum field in 1981, I became more aware of how food and culture intersected. The worlds that opened up by experiencing a variety of cuisines, plus the allure of fine dining, and the sensory jolt from encountering truly fresh ingredients, awakened something that had lain dormant. Then, whoomp, our friend Deborah gave my husband and me an unexpected wedding present, a copy of Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1, a serious tome if ever there was one. Curious, we started in with bœuf bourguignon, a dish we had seen Julia prepare on her television series, The French Chef, in 1963. Transformational! We gingerly moved on to other recipes, as if we were taking a course on cooking. And of course we were, not realizing that we were part of a large cohort of Americans who were adjusting their thinking about food and cooking. As the years have gone by, and especially since meeting Julia and collecting her entire home kitchen, I have found that her message about being open to trying new recipes and cuisines and enjoying the social and creative process of cooking resonated even with me. As I came to know more about her and her culinary legacy, as well as how she lived her life fully and with unwavering passion, I have embraced the vast universe of food history and culture. This universe includes cookware, recipes, kitchen design, cooking techniques, food memories, and larger issues of food systems, health, and access that I would have dismissed in my youthful focus on a professional identity outside of the domestic sphere. What I didn't realize then was that Julia had flipped the script. Her home kitchen, that domestic place, was the rigorously professional space that launched, nurtured, and made possible her remarkable career. For most of their history, museums have housed collections of artifacts, documents, artworks, and other types of what scholars call material culture, the objects that reflect where we came from, who we are, what we have created for various purposes, and what has mattered to us over time. While digital technology has both added to and shifted our ideas about preserving and sharing interpretations of the past, most museums continue to value the real thing, the material evidence of life as experienced by diverse people over time. With storage and exhibition space limited, and the costs of caring for artifacts ever rising, 21st century museums in the United States are grappling with the realities of collecting ever more objects. Arguments to cut back on collecting are often bolstered by explanations that preserving the material past is no longer justified in a digital world. This book takes exception to that view and aims to demonstrate that collecting the real thing, including an entire home kitchen, provides a wealth of opportunities for reflection, inspiration, and understanding in ways that cannot be accomplished on a screen. Julia's Kitchen has been on view almost continuously since 2002, providing ample opportunity for us, known as Team Julia, to observe how the Smithsonian's large and diverse audiences respond to seeing it and learning about it from our word-limited but lively exhibition labels. The kitchen draws people closer. They speak to and ask questions of each other, and sometimes muse silently by themselves. They want more, and they tell us so. This book aims to bring together the stories about the kitchen from people who actually spent time there cooking with Julia, helping her to test recipes, enjoying a meal, and taping three television series. Listeners can skip through at their leisure and access the backstories of objects, including tales that go beyond the familiar themes, such as more butter and dropping a carcass on television, that, true or not, are firmly ensconced in the popular imagination surrounding Julia Child. This is a chance for us, after caring for, another way of saying curating, the kitchen for 2 decades, to share the stories we've learned in our research, to answer questions asked frequently by our visitors, and to offer listeners a window into Julia's formidable legacy. Julia Child was an extraordinary individual whose influence and legacy continued to expand even 20 years after her death in 2004. The basic contours of her story are by now well known to many, but always worth revisiting for new generations of fans. Born Julia McWilliams in Pasadena, California, on August 15, 1912, she grew up in a world of wealth and privilege. Her father, John McWilliams, was a conservative businessman, and her mother, Carolyn, Caro, was socially active and, like her peers, not one to spend time engaging in domestic chores. Their 3 children, Julia, John, born in 1914, and Dorothy, born in 1917, were athletic, active, and friendly with other children in the neighborhood. Julia's childhood awareness of food and cooking was largely limited to the labors of hired cooks who prepared typical American fare, fat roasted chicken with buttery mashed potatoes and creamed spinach, or well-marbled porterhouse steaks, delicious but not refined food. Many years later, she described the kitchen in her Pasadena home as a dismal place. She attended a boarding school, the Catherine Branson School in Marin County, and was admitted to Smith College, her mother's alma mater, in Northampton, Massachusetts. Julia described herself as an adolescent nut in college and labeled her college career as a wild ride. The trip from the West Coast to Eastern universities was an adventure, with some 40 to 50 students traveling together by train. She recalled that the trip was one long party, which lasted about 5 days. On campus, she continued having a good time, remembering consuming large quantities of jelly donuts and driving around to speakeasies. Yes, this was during the Prohibition. The car packed with giggling girls. At Smith reunions, she admitted to campus pranks, describing how she painted a toilet seat red and how she hung a green rug across a fire rope to divide her dorm room so that her studious roommate could work in peace. Still, Julia couldn't resist tossing jelly donuts over the rug, a prank that led to separate but side-by-side rooms for the 2 friends the following year. When Julia graduated in 1934, she didn't have much of a plan for the future. Expected to find a husband and settle into a life of comfort, she worked briefly in New York before returning to California in 1937, where her restlessness and dissatisfaction grew. Years later, she spoke about the disquietude of that time when she explained, "In my generation, except for a few people who'd gone into banking or nursing or something like that, middle-class women didn't have careers. You were to marry and have children and be a nice mother. You didn't go out and do anything. I found that I got restless a year or two after going home to Pasadena. I must have always been independent because that kind of life I just couldn't do. It didn't fulfill anything." Yearning for a larger purpose, in 1941, and with the possibility of war looming, she volunteered for the Red Cross, taking the civil service exam after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Like thousands of young women from across the country who became known as government girls, Julia moved to Washington, D.C. in 1942 to help the war effort via an office job. She began working for the Office of War Information in the Department of State and was transferred to the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the Central Intelligence Agency, where she was a file clerk. A file clerk with access to sensitive documents, to be sure. Although she was not a spy, she worked for a spy agency. To her excitement, Julia was selected to travel to remote areas of the world on behalf of the OSS, an opportunity that fed her curiosity about lives lived outside of her limited experience. It was on this assignment that she met Paul Child, her future life partner, who had been hired by the OSS for his considerable artistic skills to create maps, charts, and diagrams. Child was also a photographer, writer, poet, and Renaissance man who was 10 years older than Julia, and had already traveled the world and experienced the pleasures of good food and wine. Their work assignments took them and their colleagues to Sri Lanka, then known as Ceylon, and China, where Julia's senses were jolted awake. She found Chinese food wonderful, and later declared, "The war was the change in my life." Indeed, not only did it give her a sense of purpose and a chance to see the world, but it also brought her and Paul Child together into the strong and lasting partnership that shaped her life in food. After the war, their OSS work came to an abrupt halt as the unit was summarily disbanded. The couple married in Pennsylvania in 1946 and moved to Washington, D.C., where they lived in Georgetown and purchased a house on Olive Street in 1948. Soon after, they departed for Paris, where Paul served as the exhibits officer for the U.S. Information Service. Julia's palate was aroused again when they stopped in the historic city of Rouen for a meal of perfectly prepared sole meuniere, salade verte with vinaigrette, her first real French baguette, a bottle of Puy Fumé, a dessert of fromage blanc, and dark, strong café filtre. She recalled that, "At La Couronne, I experienced fish and a dining experience of a higher order than any I'd ever had before." This epiphanic meal, enhanced by the excitement of embarking on a new life chapter in France with the husband she adored, clarified for Julia that her restless yen for something more was crystallizing around her passion for food and her desire to learn the fundamentals of French cooking and cuisine. Off she went to culinary school, but not just any academy, but the famous Le Cordon Bleu, where she spent 2 days in a course for women that Julia judged too elementary for her level of knowledge and ambitions. The school's owner, Madame Elisabeth Brasser, declared that Julia was not advanced enough for the haute cuisine course, but offered her a spot in a class for professional restaurateurs. Julia accepted and met her fellow classmates, 11 former GIs who were enrolled under the auspices of the GI Bill of Rights. "Looking back," she remarked, "luckily I had spent most of the war in male-dominated environments and wasn't fazed by them in the least." Though she was the only woman in the class, at 6'3", she stood taller than her French instructors, as well as her fellow American students. At age 38, Julia turned out to be a serious student after all, and with a great deal of practice and diligence, she mastered the techniques of classical cuisine at Le Cordon Bleu. As the spouse of an American diplomat in post-war Paris, she also had an active social calendar and met many people, including two French culinary experts, Simone Simca-Beck and Louisette Bertol, with whom she formed key relationships. The three set up an informal school in Julia and Paul's apartment for American women wishing to learn the basics of French cuisine. Called L'École des Trois Gourmandes, the School of Three Hearty Eaters, they used these teaching sessions also to test their ideas for a cookbook, one that would teach American home cooks the fundamental techniques and recipes of French cuisine. This experience revealed to Julia her love and affinity for teaching and learning, which never diminished throughout her long life. Les Trois Gourmandes turned their attention to compiling and testing French recipes for American cooks, an endeavor that took on epic dimensions for the entire decade of the 50s. As told by Julia and her great-nephew Alex Prudhomme in their 2006 book, My Life in France, as well as in her voluminous correspondence published in As Always, Julia, edited by Joan Reardon, the three friends, strong personalities all, took very different approaches to writing and testing recipes. Julia was very disciplined about operational proof, setting up experiments and meticulously tracking the result, while Simca wrote from her deep knowledge of French cuisine and cooking techniques. Louisette was less involved overall. For years, the three were wedded to the idea that the cookbook would be a compendium, a thorough guide to French cuisine's master recipes and their variations. It is important to point out that this work was carried out without computers, email, or even fax machines, but in typed pages that Julia produced on a manual typewriter, a proficiency gained during her years of office work during World War II. What's more, the project extended well past Julia and Paul's residency in Paris, which ended in 1953, when they moved to Marseille in the south of France for Paul's new posting, still as a cultural attaché with the U.S. Department of State. It extended through their next move to Bonn, Germany, where they resided from 1954 to 1956, then through their brief return to the United States, and through Paul's last posting in Oslo, Norway, from 1959 to 1961. This meant that the cookbook collaborators had to communicate with each other and exchange drafts of recipes by mail. Unsurprisingly, the process of editing and revising each other's work became an often exasperating exercise in cultural relations. Throughout this time, the challenge of securing an American publisher tried Julia's patience and ordinarily cheerful disposition. Avis Devoto, a friend in Cambridge, Massachusetts, provided guidance toward an eventual contract with Houghton Mifflin in Boston. Avis's husband Bernard, an eminent Harvard historian, had first caught Julia's attention with a column in Harper's Magazine complaining about the sorry state of American stainless steel knives. Julia sent him a letter on March 8, 1952, agreeing with his assessment of American cutlery, and enclosed a...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?